Welcome to Spider on the Web number 21, and welcome to Rio de Janeiro's airport, Galeão, pardon my pronunciation, the name of the opening track of James Raymond's beautiful CD, Toda a Beleza. I often put this track on when I sit down to write, because it makes me think of arriving at a new magical destination I've always wanted to travel to. It would be great one day to finally meet the family of my son-in-law, Heron Gonçalves da Silva of Niterói. Take me away, James. Providing the music for my darling Jeannie's Stardance IMAX movie. For the latest on her trip to Zero G later this month to try out the choreography for real, visit www.stardancemovie.com. Before I do anything else, I must share my joy and give thanks to those of you who were able this week to drop some money in the metaphorical hat there on the sidewalk next to my guitar case, or more literally, by clicking one of the donation or subscription buttons at my site. Bless your hearts, spleens, and islets of Langerhans, one and all. That settles it. This podcast is here to stay. I'm going to email each of you a JPG of an all-purpose greeting card designed by Robert A. Heinlein, hand-altered for this purpose and signed by Jeannie and me. Thanks also to those who shared their knowledge and solved my bandwidth problem. So far, these podcasts have careened from science fact to science fiction to science opinion to silence-improving music. This week, I'm going to try something new, and as dangerous as sweating dynamite, science dogma. We're going to discuss one of the newest and strangest mental diseases our species has yet developed, pursuing scientific facts with religious fervor. That's right, friends. You are listening to the bravest son of a bitch in podcasting today, and it's time to get the kids ready for bed, because today I'm going to give equal time to evil itself, to several insidious, perfidious, hideous proponents of the ultimate heresy, including, in fact, the Antichrist himself, Martin Durkin. That's right, we're going to discuss a documentary so monstrous that at least three other entire documentaries have been made specifically to refute its filthy lies one by one. There's going to be a documentary made about it soon. We're going to speak of the British documentary, I shudder even to mention its wicked name, The Great Global Warming Swindle. But first, I want to stir up your blood a little with some globally warming music. I play Toda a Beleza when I sit down to write, but I play this next track when I'm done and I'm ready to have some fun. I played you some Breeze K.L. Sachs a couple of podcasts ago, a track called Gospel Lullaby from his CD State of My Heart. It was written with his best friend and partner, Brian Malament, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, who plays piano on the track. I regret to report he had to leave here last year. Breeze, you'll recall, is a baritone sax player and one of the unforgivably many people who got aced by the Army Corps of Engineers, fucked by FEMA, and buggered by Bush. Katrina took his home, and the Breeze got blown to Memphis. Guess what? So did a whole shitload of other great players. If you're good enough to blow in New Orleans, it's an obvious destination. Breeze and a bunch of these expats recently banded together under the name of the New Orleans Jazz Ramblers, and I want you to hear a taste of the early results. And I do mean early. Bear in mind as you listen that the Ramblers walked into the studio literally at the crack of dawn, unpacked their axes, and without even a warm-up, counted off and recorded this cold. It's called the Blackbird Special. Imagine what they could have done with a cup of coffee in them. I think of that as the Ramblers' musical, Bite Us, We're Still Here, to the bastards who betrayed them and their city, including the institutions and alleged humans I cited earlier. Tell it, cousins. For more of that kind of music, go to www.acidplanet.com and hunt around for the New Orleans Jazz Ramblers. Maybe your donations could help them get their CD out there in the wind and make them a few bucks. Now we're in a mood to disturb some shit. Let's talk about the documentary, The Great Global Warming Swindle. I'm going to presume that no one will object too litigiously if I play you just the audio for just the show's opening 5-minute teaser segment. And I'll explain why a little later on. If you know anything at all about global warming, you must know its most indisputable, irrefutable fact, and you're probably getting a bit tired of hearing it, namely, that the scientific debate is over! I mean, science is more certain and unanimous about this than it is about relativity, quantum physics, or even evolution. Beyond any reasonable doubt, runaway temperature increase is an apocalyptic peril that threatens us all, and it is caused by human activity, specifically industrial civilization. And I would like to make it very, very clear at the outset that I am on board with this. Do not doubt it for a moment, and promise I never will. But for the sake of something once popular in North America and now discarded, called free speech, let me draw your attention to some advocates of the devil himself. I tried editing this to identify each speaker as they appear, but there's just no practical way to do a caption in audio. I'll identify them all by name and occupation at the end of the teaser. Here's the opening of The Great Global Warming Swindle.
When people say we don't believe in global warming, I say, no, I believe in global warming. I don't believe that human CO2 is causing that warming.
A few years ago, if you would ask me, I would tell you it's CO2. Why? Because just like everyone else in the public, I listened to what the media had to say.
Each day, the news reports grow more fantastically apocalyptic. Politicians no longer dare to express any doubt about climate change.
There is such intolerance of any dissenting voice.
Are some of the worst climate criminals on the planet.
This is the most politically incorrect thing possible, is to doubt this climate change orthodoxy.
Global warming has gone beyond politics. It is a new kind of morality.
Now, the Prime Minister's back from his holidays, unrepentant and unembarrassed about yet another long-haul destination.
Yet, as the frenzy over man-made global warming grows shriller, many senior climate scientists say the actual scientific basis for the theory is crumbling.
There were periods, for example, in Earth's history when we had 3 times as much CO2 as we have today, or periods when we had 10 times as much CO2 as we have today. And if CO2 has a large effect on climate, then you should see it in the temperature reconstruction.
If we look at climate through the geological time frame, we would never suspect CO2 as a major climate driver.
None of the major climate changes in the last 1,000 years can be explained by CO2.
We can't say that CO2 will drive climate. It certainly never did in the past.
I've often heard it said that there is a consensus of thousands of scientists on the global warming issue and that humans are causing a catastrophic change to the climate system. Well, I am one scientist, and there are many that simply think that is not true.
Man-made global warming is no ordinary scientific theory.
This morning, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change made up of...
It is presented in the media as having the stamp of authority of an impressive international organization.
From the IPCC,
the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC.
The IPCC, like any UN body, is political. The final conclusions are politically driven.
This claim that the IPCC is the world's top 1,500 or 2,500 scientists. You look at the bibliographies of the people and it's simply not true. There are quite a number of non-scientists.
And to build the number up to 2,500, they have to start taking reviewers and government people and so on, anyone who ever came close to them. And none of them are asked to agree. Many of them disagree.
Those people who are specialists but don't agree with the polemic and resign, and there have been a number that I know of, they are simply put on the author list and become part of this 2,500 of the world's top scientists?
People have decided you have to convince other people that since no scientist disagrees, you shouldn't disagree either. But that, whenever you hear that in science, that's pure propaganda.
This is the story of how a theory about climate turned into a political ideology.
See, I don't even like to call it the environmental movement anymore, because really it is a political activist movement, and they have become hugely influential at a global level.
It is the story of the distortion of a whole area of science.
Climate scientists need there to be a problem in order to get funding.
We have a vested interest in creating panic, because then money will flow to climate science.
There's one thing you shouldn't say, and that is, this might not be a problem.
It is the story of how a political campaign turned into a bureaucratic bandwagon.
Fact of the matter is that tens of thousands of jobs depend upon global warming right now. It's a big business.
It's become a great industry in itself. And if the whole global warming farrago collapsed, there'd be an awful lot of people out of jobs and looking for work.
This is a story of censorship and intimidation.
I have seen and heard their spitting fury at anybody who might disagree with them, which is not the scientific way.
It is a story about Westerners invoking the threat of climatic disaster to hinder vital industrial progress in the developing world.
One clear thing that emerges from the whole environmental debate is the point that there's somebody keen to kill the African dream, and the African dream is to develop.
The environmental movement has evolved into the strongest force there is for preventing development in the developing countries.
The global warming story is a cautionary tale of how a media scare became the defining idea of a generation.
The whole global warming business has become like a religion. And people who disagree are called heretics. I'm a heretic. The makers of this program are all heretics.
Well, who are these heretics? In order of their first appearance, they are Professor Tim Ball, Department of Climatology, University of Winnipeg, Professor Nir Shaviv, Institute of Physics, University of Jerusalem, Lord Lawson of Blaby, Professor Ian Clark, Department of Earth Sciences, University of Ottawa, Dr. Piers Corbin, Climate Forecaster, Weather Action, Professor John Christie, Lead Author, IPCC, Professor Philip Stott, Department of Biogeography, University of London, Professor Paul Reiter, IPCC and Pasteur Institute, Paris. To help orient you, the next guy, the Richard Dreyfuss and Jaws-sounding dude, is Professor Richard Linson, IPCC, and MIT, followed by Patrick Moore, founder of Greenpeace, Dr. Roy Spencer, Weather Satellite Team Leader, NASA, Professor Patrick Michaels, Department of Environmental Sciences, University of Virginia, James Shikwati, economist and author, and the final speaker, the sweet old guy who admits they're all heretics, is Nigel Calder, former editor of the highly esteemed journal New Scientist. There then follows over an hour of substantiating details. As you can imagine, when the show aired, the feces entered the turban, resulting in a shitstorm that reverberated around the world. Literally, there was even thunder down under at Channel 4's blunder. Righteously enraged by this clear attempt to excuse capitalism, the forces of good rose in their wrath and struck back. With the usual interesting gross overkill, at least three full-length documentaries have already been produced and aired denouncing Durkin and his diabolical disinformation so far in just 1 year. And I'm quite sure more are on the way. Durkin is apparently the Michael Moore of science, the filmmaker whose enemies enjoy hating him so much they just can't help themselves. I've sampled all three rebuttals, and the least shrill and most interesting has been July's The Great Global Warming Swindle Debate by ABC Australia. It features a short one-on-one confrontation with Durkin himself by host Tony Jones, which makes it quite clear that Jones appears on camera for a living and Durkin does not, and lengthy debate by a balanced panel of experts, a few of whom feel Durkin deserves our compassion and might one day be rehabilitated, and commentary from audience members who weren't selected at all. It just happens that everyone who speaks up for Durkin is a wandering lunatic, because, hey, who else would, right? I have to say, I thought Durkin handled himself pretty well for a guy being asked if he'd stop beating his and everybody else's wife. And the most significant charge raised against him, that he deliberately and grossly misrepresented the views of one of the scientists who appears in the program, is so demonstrably a crock of shit that after examining all the man's footage and all his correspondence with Durkin, Channel 4's most paranoid lawyers welcomed his lawsuit, whereupon he dropped it. His name was Wunsch, not Welch. But naturally, in a question of planetary importance like this, you don't want to take anybody's word for anything. You want to check it out for yourself, and good for you. I can help you. First, the bad news. The reason I decided to take a chance on giving you an audio excerpt from The Great Global Warming Swindle is that I made a serious attempt to purchase it commercially and came up empty. I went to Amazon.com and turned up only a single used copy at an exorbitant price. Apparently, Channel 4 has abandoned any intention of commercial distribution. The good news, with no effort at all, I found copies of both the original documentary and all three refutations at every BitTorrent site I tried. You can download all of them for free in a variety of video formats, including DVD, both NTSC and PAL, AVI, MPEG, and others. If you don't grok BitTorrenting yet, backtrack to Spider on the Web number 19 and take my tutorial on how to do it. It's simple. Then, to find these particular torrents, go to any of the following sites and sign up. www.thepiratebay.org, www.torrentbox.com, www.torrentspy.com, www.mybittorrent.com, or just Google around until you find a source. At least one of those sites has recently had to close its cyber doors to American residents, Papa Spank. There's also a Wikipedia article on the subject that's comparatively unbiased, but I'm afraid that's faint praise. Download those documentaries and decide for yourself. I myself hold no opinion one way or the other. I don't even concede that one way and the other are the only valid options. I really don't. But I will say this much. I don't know a whole lot about climate science since I left college 35 years ago. Just what you pick up from reading Science, Scientific American, New Scientist, and Discover regularly, and keeping your ears open at meetings of the Lunarian Group. But I have considerable, extensive, and intimate experience with zealotry. I can smell zealotry a kilometer away, hidden in a herd of goats. It smells very much like burning flesh. I don't see that it makes a difference whether it's religious zealotry, Marxist zealotry, or scientific zealotry. They all smell the same, sound the same, and are equally suspect. Truth doesn't need bullies to champion it. Zealotry is always the enemy of rationality, and I have some firmly fixed opinions on rationality. I have to admit it was fascinating when Durkin zoomed in on Al Gore's famous thousand-year chart from An Inconvenient Truth, in which graphs of global temperature and global CO2 clearly and unmistakably march in lockstep for the whole 1,000 years. And you got in so close, you saw that for the first time, that for that entire 1,000 years, just as consistently, the rises in CO2 come 200 to 800 years after the rises in temperature, rather than before them. How they could be causing them is, therefore, a bit of a puzzler. But hey, you know, maybe the ice core records are lying. Another one of God's witty attempts to mislead us with a false historical record, to test our faith. I didn't mean to freak you out. Let's change the subject. Since I've gotten you stirred up, it behooves me to cool you with some soothing, healing music. Let me briefly explain why I'm pretty sure this will do it. One morning a few years ago, I started noticing inexplicable bursts of bright light at the very edges of my peripheral vision in one eye, followed soon by a blizzard of black specks across its whole visual field. Those are the symptoms of a detaching retina. Soon, I was in the car, on the ferry to the mainland, being driven into Vancouver by my wife to the eye doctor's office, and I don't mind telling you, I was shared skitless. My eyes are my life. The whole trip takes a little over an hour. I expected to spend it in hell. Desperate for distraction, I turned to music, which never fails me. There were at least 50 CDs in the car as usual. I went only for old favorites I was sure would help. The first half dozen I tried were all vile, all made me feel worse, all battered my attention. I gave up and went with silence, and that was worse. Then my eye fell on a new one I'd just bought, the double CD Crosby Nash by David Crosby and Graham Nash. I shrugged and booted disc one. The first track was, like a lot of the ones that followed, written by the same James Raymond I opened this podcast with, and here is that track, Lay Me Down. Imagine yourself half blind and half crazy with fear, nothing to do for an hour but imagine the worst. And then you hear this.
The windmills, and some of them were still. Sometimes it's hard to catch the wind and bend it to your will. Even though it's hard to know just how the story ends. The road is long and it takes its time. On that you can depend. Lay me down in the river and wash this place away. Break me down like sand from a stone. Maybe I'll be whole again one day. Lay me down. Lay me down. Maybe I'll be whole again. Lay me down. Lay me down. Maybe I'll be whole again. Somewhere between heaven and hell, a soul knows where it's been. I want to feel my spirit lifted up and catch my breath again. Lay me down in the river and wash this place away. Break me down like sand from a stone. Maybe I'll be whole again one day. Lay me down. Lay me down. Maybe I'll be whole again. Lay me down. Lay me down. Maybe I'll be whole again. Lay me down. Lay me down. Maybe I'll be whole again one day.
that got me to the chair sane with a reasonable blood pressure. God bless the Canadian medical system, and I mean that. I would take up arms to defend it if I have to. Within 2 hours of the first onset of symptoms, I was under the laser, and a retina was saved, and I got away with, like, no vision loss at all, maybe a couple of little floaters, which is incredibly lucky. My friend Donald Westlake lost, like, months of work because he was less fortunate. He happened to be out of the country when his came on. He didn't get to the laser quite as fast. Anyway, I testify that that is healing music. And now it's time for a little bit of Spider Robinson content in this podcast. So I guess I'm going to read you one of the op-ed columns I wrote for Canada's national newspaper, The Globe and Mail, some of the more timeless of which are available in the collection The Crazy Years, available from Ben Bella Books. Here's one now. First printed in June 2001, it is called Loathe Yourself? Fine. Leave me out of it. The very first story I ever wrote, The Dreaming Dervish, concerned a beautiful dancer in a trance, endlessly spinning in a transport of ecstasy, whose concentration is disturbed when she notices she has contracted fleas. She takes steps to change her blood chemistry. The fleas are exterminated. The dance goes on. Tomato surprise! The dancer is Mother Gaia. The blood is her fresh water. The fleas were us! Ta-da! In my defense, I was 20. The year was 1969. The story was written for free and worth every cent. I evolved. My first novel, Telepath, a few years later, involved a genius who found a way to make nasty industrial civilization vanish overnight by simply enhancing everyone's sense of smell a thousandfold. He soon learned that civilization at its worst never smelled as bad as 6 billion rotting corpses, and that when the few starving survivors redefine you as dinner, industry, at least the part that used to produce 44 caliber fire sticks, can come to have retroactive charms. I decided by then, in other words, that for me, if it ever comes down to a choice between noble Mother Gaia and my filthy, quarrelsome fellow monkeys, and it does all the time, I vote for us. We can get more planets, build them from scratch if we must, but the universe can never get another human race. And would be poorer for the loss. That's the key right there. The single most important question we have to face if we're to survive this new millennium is, do we deserve to? Or are we, when you come right down to it, just too disgusting to live? I don't care how healthy Gaia is if there are no humans left aboard to appreciate her splendor. I have difficulty believing any rational person could feel otherwise. But over the years since I wrote Telepath, I've watched with astonished dismay as more and more of my contemporaries, not ignorant peasants but expensively educated aristocrats, have come to feel this planet would be a far nicer place if only there weren't any damn people on it. God forbid we go to space and despoil Mars, too. I believe this attitude to be insane, profoundly sick, a brain virus that may turn out to be the most deadly of all the psychic cancers we've created for ourselves. It bespeaks a deep, species-wide self-loathing, which I suspect may result from deep personal self-loathing given too much free time to fester. Perhaps it made a kind of sense during the period when two loud-mouthed governments deemed it in their own best interest to repeatedly warn the world that the end of everything was, in Mr. Jagger's words, just a shot away. If you believed total doom was inevitable, then loathing your own species was a way of saying, hey, those grapes were sour anyway. But that period ended. And still we have endless articles like last week's recent four-part series, Are We on the Road to Extinction?, whose clear subtext is that we deserve to be. Or conferences like the one held at UBC a few years ago, Remaining Human in the Face of Our Growing Dependence on Technology, in which 250 visibly well-nourished philosophers, psychologists, spiritual seekers, alternative health practitioners, entertainers, and even a slumming scientist or two came by jet plane from around the planet to agree with each other that technology is toxic, consumerism is unnatural, computers cause alienation and loneliness, civilization pollutes, and we're stressing the ecosystem to the point of collapse. Oddly, none of them volunteered to kill or sterilize themselves. Consume means eat. There is a technical term for life forms which do not consume. We call these dead. Consumerism is utterly natural. Everything alive is a consumer. Only humans have learned, or ever tried, to occasionally accomplish it without bloodshed. Everything alive pollutes. Excretion is part of the definition of life. Only humans make any effort to regulate or recycle their wastes. Every life form grows until it stresses its environment and is slapped back down again. Humans are the only ones who even attempt to live in harmony with their environment. For damn sure, they're the only ones who think they should be better at it and keep trying to learn how. Computers cause alienation and loneliness? Only in those too afraid to use them. Everyone else is busily forming an astonishing multitude of new planet-wide communities based on shared interests, communities stronger and more tolerant and generous than any ever seen before in history. Technology is toxic? But for technology, I'd have died at 15 when I had my first lung collapse. Without trifocal technology, I'd be too blind to read, write, or drive safely. In my 20s, I spent several years in the woods, deliberately trying to live without technology, in order to minimize the footprint I was leaving on the ecology. Finally, I realized I was enlarging it. A wood stove is more polluting and energy wasteful than electric heat, and offers constant risk of serious injury from saw to chopping block to firebox. Kerosene is more polluting, dangerous, and energy expensive than electric light, and stinks. I never did learn how to make my own axe heads, knives, stoves, horseshoes, plow, or even typewriter. Even with such aids, I spent every waking minute trying to survive. Today, I fritter away most of my time thinking deep thoughts, writing trenchant essays, reading good books, and writing better ones, on a computer nobody even dreamed of back when I wrote The Dreaming Dervish in longhand. If you want to believe my life in the woods was somehow nobler, purer, I urge you to try it yourself. People without technology tend to bury most of their children and to die before 30 themselves. Often with relief. The problem with technology is the large number of people who haven't got it yet. There's nothing wrong with this planet that couldn't be cured by making everyone on it rich. We may never conquer envy, but we can unquestionably abolish need if we put our minds to it. The way to do that is the method that's been working steadily for the last 3 centuries now: more, better, more efficient, cleaner, smarter, more humane technology. You can obtain The Crazy Years and just about any of my titles that are still in print, signed and personalized through the mail from White Dwarf Books in Vancouver. Just steer your browser to deadright.com/wd.html. That was deadright, deadwrite.com/wd.html. Walter and Jill keep a stock of everything I've got, and I drop into town every week or two and sign books. They also maintain a U.S. mailing address so that you can get the books with no customs nonsense or extra charges. It's a great deal. Check them out. Okay, everybody knows that the greatest guitar instrumental ever recorded was Amos Garrett's Sleepwalk. I'm going to shamelessly boast that I had the great honor to be in the booth when it was recorded. I still possess the pick that Amos cracked playing that incredible last chorus. I'm going to play you a little bit of a lick from it now. I can't play you much because I have his permission, but not that of Santo and Johnny Farina, who wrote the song. It's from the album I Make My Home in My Shoes. Here's a little bit of Amos Garrett's version of Sleepwalk. If you're a guitar player yourself, hearing that for the first time, I think I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, where do I go to surrender? And if I say to you, what's your idea of heaven? You're probably going to say, my idea of heaven would be, say, Amos Garrett himself sits down with me and takes me through that whole track, lick by lick, and furthermore agrees to come back and show me again anytime I want. I mean, that's not going to happen, but you ask my idea of heaven, I got you covered. Go to www.learnrootsmusic.com and you will find that very thing, a DVD you can purchase of Amos taking you through Sleepwalk a lick at a time and also teaching you some invaluable secrets. I learned, for instance, how to string a guitar after 35, 40 years of playing one. You'll also find other kinds of instructional videos that will teach you equally amazing things, if perhaps a little bit less deal-with-the-devilish than Amos's multiple string bending technique. Just for one example, there's a DVD there by Sam Hurry, Doug Cox's longtime collaborator, which will teach you how to play slide guitar in conventional tuning. Or at least appear to. Again, there's a little bit of deal-with-the-devil in all of this stuff. To learn that and all kinds of other funky musical techniques and tricks, go to www.learnrootsmusic.com, yet another enterprise by Doug Cox, who, by the way, has a new album out with Sam Hurry, an incredible play called Blues from the Forbidden Plateau. See dougcox.com. Or you can read about it on my website, diary@www.spiderrobinson.com. All right, it's time to close this podcast off. I just want to thank you all one more time for your kindness, for your generosity, for the warmth of your support that's come in the last week. I really do appreciate it, and I'm going to keep on doing this for just as long as I can continue to find stuff to bring you. Here's some good stuff right now, a track by the brilliant singer-songwriter guitarist Todd Butler of Comox, B.C. Like Doug Cox, he's from Vancouver Island. Like Doug Cox, he's a genius. He also happens to be one of the funniest sons of bitches alive when he's in that mood. But I'm going to play his comedy music another time. Right now, I just want to play you one that just speaks to me. It's called Feel the Hunger Burning. It's from his CD, Idle Canadian, available at toddbutler.com.
I got lost in an Ashbury daydream. A bohemian beckoned to me, said, open your eyes, put your feet to the flame, and feel the hunger burning. I awoke and I couldn't get back to sleep. It's like a dirty little secret that I had to keep. I could feel the world dissolving under me and feel the hunger burning. Lying awake and I wonder where did the garden. Flies in the eyes of democracy. Feel the hunger burning. Let freedom reign in the land of. flow from the hearts of the flower children. Feel the hunger. Feel the world turn. Can you hear the children cry? Do you feel a hunger burn? How do you sleep at night?
Feel that hunger burning. And the one sure thing is there ain't no simple answers to the problems. Hey, can my man Todd play a guitar or what? You like that? Check out his latest CD, an instrumental album called Hamburger Soup, in which he basically runs roughshod through just about every musical genre there is, with the possible exception of klezmer. In weeks to come, I hope to play you some of his funny stuff, and you're gonna love it. I'm about out of time now. Come back next week when the podcast will basically focus on music, and I suspect I'll end up telling you about the most exciting science fiction novel I've read in at least the last 5 years. I hope the author won't be horrified to hear it so described. That's next week. Here with one last evocation of that hunger we all feel burning is one last song from the Crosby Nash CD. But do please remember that, like all of them, episode 21 of Spider on the Web is being podcast under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial, share alike. All copyrighted material remains fully protected. Here now are, one last time, are David Crosby and Graham Nash from the 2004 double CD, Crosby Nash. It's very short and very spare, but anything you added to it would spoil it. And I tell you, when Graham comes in on the harmonies halfway through, it just makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck. Here now, David Crosby and Graham Nash with Samurai. See you next week.
Spirit son of a samurai, tilting at windmills, a misfit in this century. He was looking for a living to be proud of. Well, he was driven before a dozen winds at once, like a salmon jumping upstream without the fish's sense not to wonder. Well, he was carrying his baggage chained to his feet, his weapon held across his eyes. He was looking for the light. He was looking for the light. Well, he was the only one I met on the road.